Hello, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. In the middle of April, coming to the end of Lent 2019, a few days ago, the Romanesque Cathedral of Notre Dame was burnt, though I'm not entirely sure how a building made of stone can burn, but I guess everything not made of stone went up in flames. And I'm not going to talk about that now, but I wrote on Facebook to some of my friends that this is essentially a formality. I mean, the bourgeois tourists who go see that every year don't know the first thing about it. They couldn't tell you what Romanesque versus Gothic architecture is. They don't know anything about the symbolism of the Middle Ages or theology or anything. It's just a bourgeois, middle-class kind of amusement. And I likened it to the cremation of a corpse rather than any kind of a death or murder. It's symbolic only. And maybe we'll talk about that tomorrow on the Daily Nationalist. But for now, I want to talk about another conflagration. And that's the Vietnam War. We've dealt with so many of the great Asian anti-communists on this show. And we deal with them because they're ignored. These leaders and these events, even among historians, are complete black spots, just like anything else of value amongst academics and journalists. And so, of course, no one knows anything about these events. As I've said before, it's really the theme of my whole life, is that everything that even the educated American believes about the world is storytelling and mythology. They don't really know anything. They live in fantasy land. They live in a bubble. My entire life, and I don't care what the cost, is to burst that bubble. And I'm going to do some of that today. This is going to be a thematic description rather than a year-by-year analysis. So we'll be bouncing around different eras, starting from 1945 and ending up really almost to the present day. But most people associate the Vietnam War with Lyndon Johnson. And the war was meant to be lost, as we all know by now. The war against what the regime thought communism was, which is really Russianism to a lot of these people, was never a real factor. The Americans were making a fortune trading with the Soviet Union, precisely as the same Soviet Union was financing North Vietnam. So it shows you how seriously this was taken. Because there was no elite support for the war, this is an issue where the state and the ruling class had deviated. And we know that the anti-war movement was created by the ruling class because there is no anti-war movement today. But LBJ never really gave a goal. Was it to preserve South Vietnam and turn it into another South Korea? Was it to unify Vietnam under Saigon? Was it to prevent Marxism spreading in Southeast Asia? Was it to challenge the Soviet Union? Was it to challenge China? Was it to, what was it? Was it to give it back to the French? I mean, what was the purpose of this war? And it was never explained. There was very little contact between American generals and admirals and civilian leadership, and what advice was given, usually rejected by the very ignorant McNamara. There was a misuse of weaponry, a misuse of firepower. It was an assumption that this was going to be a variation of a typical European war. But the key issue, the key above all keys, the issue above all issue was that Hanoi was willing to sacrifice its entire population, if necessary, to win. victory became a goal in and of itself. Even the JCS in the U.S. really didn't have a coherent strategy. Whatever advice they gave, of course, McNamara rejected, and really it came down to fighting three wars, the ground war, the air war, and the Ho Chi Minh Trail, and to some extent, when it bulged out into Cambodia. I've always been fascinated by the ARVN, or the Army of the Republic of Vietnam, because despite it being one of the largest and best supplied armies on the planet, it had the fourth largest air force in the world by 1972, it fell to pieces in a fairly short period of time. Well, there was no unified command. In other words, the United States really didn't, not until it was too late, take command over the ARVN. And of course, the other issue, just below the Hanoi issue, is the complete lack of leadership in Saigon. It's not to say that these men weren't good men, whether it be Ky, Thieu, or Diem. It was rather that they didn't last long enough, and soldiers didn't know when orders would change, or even what they were fighting for. Now, you'll see a bit later that the North Vietnamese saw the ARVN as a formidable force. They were no joke. The other problem is, of course, despite Diem's great intellect, post-Diem, there was no unifying ideology. You had the same thing in the Russian Civil War. And in both cases, you had the Reds having a very firm, they lied pretty much about what they believed in, but regardless of that, they had a firm, very specific ideology, where the whites, the South Vietnamese, post-Diem, had almost nothing, nothing to unify people. You had a distinction between the Marine Corps that saw this essentially as a counterinsurgency operation to win over villages, which of course was the truth, but someone like General Westmoreland, who saw this as more traditional European war, just an extension of the war against Japan. And one of the things that this broadcast is going to answer, a question that a lot of people have, is how did the military that defeated Imperial Japan in essentially 3 years fail so miserably against tiny North Vietnam? And the Japanese had no problem dealing with Vietnam. At its height, the Allied force, including Thailand, including South Korea, including the ARVN and the United States, was far more than 1 million men, with tons of money and a tremendous air force, fell to pieces. And this is a mystery, which hopefully we're going to unravel today. The U.S. military, post-World War II, has always been somewhat of a paper tiger. It's bloated. It gets too much money. One of the things that the ARVN commanders always said was that the U.S. had way too much luxury, at least the officers did, that their bases were so lavishly appointed compared with the very Spartan Viet Cong or NVA forces. The 13th Air Force was really responsible for the air war. They were based in the Philippines, which was a problem in and of itself. It was almost a worldwide conflict. What a lot of people don't realize, especially if you were around me, I was 3 years old, 4 years old at the end, when the war ended, when Saigon fell. So I have no real personal remembrance of it. But the Tet Offensive in the late 60s was a complete, an awful defeat for the NLF, or the Viet Cong, was destroyed by both the U.S. and the ARVN, as well as a huge bloody nose to the North Vietnamese. So they had to retreat and reorganize in the North. So after the Tet Offensive, the South had essentially won. But even that wasn't sufficient. Well, the ARVN had a highly politicized officer corps, which is death for any army. They also had poor training, and because of poor leadership, they had a lack of motivation. But even after the Paris Accords, which divided the two Vietnams from one another, you had a North Vietnamese, a very large North Vietnamese military presence remaining in the South. So there was three false assumptions that went into the American approach to the Vietnam War. The first one is a complex one. It's the idea that there is a kind of a manpower breaking point as far as the North was concerned, that at some point they're going to lose enough men that they're going to give in. This is the mistake that the French made, that of course no one paid any attention to, is that they were willing to sacrifice huge numbers of men. There was no breaking point. The second misconception is that the Americans can master battlefield initiative, that they'll be the ones making the decisions, they'll be forcing the NLF on the defensive. And thirdly, that the way to defeat them was a war of attrition, showing the utter disaster of the U.S. military. All of these were incorrect. Americans aren't willing to sacrifice very much, which is why it loses every war it ever gets involved in. Because even World War II was won by the Soviet Union. I mean, half the Japanese military was on the Chinese border with the Soviet Union. I've written about the huge casualties that have been lied about in the first Iraq War, but Saddam Hussein, who had a first-rate military, who did bloody the Americans' noses in the first war, which we were told was just a total victory, but somehow Saddam Hussein was still in power, half his army was on the Turkish border. Because the Turkish army was, well, they never moved, but they still threatened. The North Vietnamese, however, both the Chinese and Korea, were willing to sacrifice huge numbers of men. They're not Christian societies, and therefore human life is of relative value. There was giant population growth in the North, and the available manpower at any given time was about 2.5, 2.8 million people. At the end of the war, you had almost that amount in uniform, either in the North or the South. Furthermore, to avoid any kind of panic, and this did not happen in the Gulf War, LBJ refused to bring up any reserve forces. The fact that the Saddam Hussein, contrary to all reports at the time, defeated the U.S. in the first Iraq War, and if you go on my Patreon, I have an article explaining this in depth, half the reserves in the U.S. were called up. That's odd if it were just this quick victory. But even worse, the U.S. is simply so incompetent in the battlefield. 1968, only about 15% of the troops available that were in South Vietnam were available for combat in any given moment. And really, it's more like 10% were competent for any kind of combat roles at the time. Both the North and the South, as I said before, were really shocked at the level of luxury that the officers enjoyed, not the grunts, of course, and certainly not the conscripts, enjoyed on the U.S. bases. And don't think that the North didn't take that into consideration, realizing that these are soft guys. Now, of course, the grunts were not. These were tough guys fighting communism. My father was one of these guys in Korea. I'm talking about the officers here, that these were men who could be defeated. The North, on the other hand, lived very Spartan lives. We'll talk about the war against France in a minute and how that factored into the American defeat. But the luxury, the prostitutes, the drugs that the officers were engaging in on base were something that the North used to their advantage. I attacked the U.S. military on a pretty daily basis, but generally speaking, I'm only talking about officers. Grunts have nothing to say, unfortunately. And I get that largely from my father, who, as a USMC Korean vet, who died in 03, had utter contempt for the officer corps. A lot of conscripts were like that. But Northern resistance began to build as the bombing campaign intensified. It was very hard to figure out the proper targets outside of the harbors, and so a lot of this was indiscriminate. Nevertheless, the targets that did exist, you had to get permission beforehand. So you had both not enough bombing and too much bombing at the same time. The bombs that were dropped had minimal effect. See, the VC was able to live, I mean, the entire NLF was able to live on maybe 380 tons of supplies per day. The US, over 2,000 were necessary to keep them going. NLF, which is just another word for the VC, the National Liberation Front, was self-sufficient. Neither the ARVN or the US were. That is not the case, of course, with South Korea. I've been in contact with the daughter of the South Korean general under General Park, who we've dealt with on this show. Actually, I can't think of his name off the top of my head, but if you go to my show on General Park of South Korea, who was a firm national socialist who called himself that, which is why the U.S. sided with the North for a short time against him, and this is why Park pulled the troops out of South Vietnam. Because they had minimal rules of engagement, the Viet Cong were told not to engage the Koreans. And the same thing went for the Thai forces from Thailand, well-trained, well-equipped, American weapons, same thing for South Korea. So it was a pretty much a unified force under an incompetent American command. The fact remains that North Vietnam sought, wanted, demanded a long drawn out war. So people like Westmoreland and the bulk of the JCS wanted this war of attrition, thinking that that North Vietnamese were just like Americans and couldn't handle sacrifices. Well, they were simply incorrect. It was they that couldn't handle sacrifices. Northern political will is the key, and I'll say this many, many times. Well, by the end of the war, the estimate is between 1.1 and 2.5 million deaths, including civilians in North Vietnam, with about 300,000 MIA. And General Giap, as we know, is the famous commander, who was against the war, by the way, in North Vietnam, sought to use attrition against the U.S. Now, Ho Chi Minh, a famous character. Some make the error in claiming that he was some sort of a nationalist. He was not. He did not call himself that. He had converted to some, pretty much the orthodox view of Leninism while a student in Paris. Same thing for Pol Pot, although that was more Maoism in his case. And the early Viet Minh, which was the first so-called national liberation force, was supplied and aided by the Chinese. And this is before the Sino-Soviet split, of course. Now, so Ho attacked the nationalist movement. We'll talk about that in a little bit. Rejected it and sought to be a part of the Soviet world. But even during the war against France, where Ho kind of made his name, one of the tactics that the North used, I mean, they were purely Machiavellian. Marxists are, again, because they're materialists. There is no soul, there is no spirit, there is no right, there is no wrong. So they could afford to be Machiavellian. Well, those with standards often struggle with that idea. So that means they're automatically at an advantage. Negotiations for Ho was nothing more than a bid for time. Stalin, prior to the split, put Vietnam under Chinese supervision. The fact is that Stalin never trusted Ho. Ho Chi Minh's strategy in the war against France was to undermine French morale, again, rightly assuming that they're not North Vietnam, but in the West, they do have a manpower breaking point. Now, President Diem of the South refused any talk with the North whatsoever. He may have been correct on this, knowing full well what Ho really was. And Eisenhower and presidents after him, well, he was murdered while Kennedy was in office, didn't like Diem and didn't trust him. Had Diem remained president, things would have been much, much different for the South. But starting in 1959, Ho began the economic collectivization under Stalinist ideology of the North. So any nationalist ideology went out the window. He followed Stalin in almost every regard. But there was tremendous pressure on Ho and the party to make war on the South, despite the fact that they were exhausted from the war against France. By 1960, the Third Congress of the Vietnamese Workers' Party, they created the National Liberation Front of the South. And then Ho created a communist provisional government for the South to act parallel to the Saigon government. And the assumption on Ho's part, you know, political issues and events like this, they all come down to who assumes what. What are the axioms that aren't negotiable in people's thought processes? And for Ho Chi Minh, he made one error, and that was the assumption that the U.S. wouldn't give a damn what was going on in Vietnam. Well, in a little bit, well, let's talk about that right now. Why did the U.S. give a damn about Vietnam? You know, in the South, Diem's point of view, as a Roman Catholic, was Ho could not be trusted. Any negotiation with him, again, is just a bid for time. He was right about that. But Ho had gone to Diem. You know, again, the South was superior to the North in every way, just like South Korea. And after massive flooding in the 40s, near the end of the war, it took a long time for the economy to recover. Collectivization was botched both in the North and in the South later on. In 1959, he approached Diem and asked for rice, and Diem gave him the middle finger, and the NLF was formed 1 year later. This is not a coincidence. But the economic structure here makes a lot of sense. Talking about 1945, what was going on? Germany was destroyed. France was in ruins. The French Empire was going up in smoke, and same thing for Great Britain. The Marshall Plan simply wasn't sufficient. The alliance with the USSR was highly problematic, although trade and aid to the Soviet Union was regular. There was no more. The Soviets refused to hand over their books to the West, and therefore they didn't receive the Marshall Plan. However, in secret, there was another version of the Marshall Plan, which included the Soviet Union, which I've written about elsewhere. And then the United Kingdom had fallen to pieces. They had to devalue the pound sterling because they were repaying debts, and there was this massive dollar drain to the United States. 1949, they devalued the pound, which was a humiliating act in the central bank. So you had oil in Vietnam, later found in Burma too. Burma was feeding most of the area. And then rubber in Malaysia, which, by the way, the British had brought in. Rubber doesn't naturally grow in Malaysia, but the industry had grown under British control in the area. And this is the origin of the American interest in Southeast Asia. Southeast Asia fed most of the continent. That region was the issue for the United States, not Vietnam as such. America feared that any lack of engagement, whether it be in Greece, whether it be in Korea, whether it be in Vietnam, would lead to America's allies thinking that the U.S. is just a lot of talk, a lot of bark and no bite. But the Sino-Soviet split, 1960-61, changed everything. We see what was going on in Singapore and Malaysia at the time, and of course South Korea, and after the war under General Park, and Taiwan. This explosion of economic development, all using national, Thailand also exploding economically, all using social nationalist type of policies, state-directed investment, import substitution, and the U.S. had little to say about it because they desperately needed them as allies. You had growing prosperity in the area, and this is what engaged the United States. This was the whole issue. And I guess Ho didn't put the pieces together. But then, 64, Nikita Khrushchev is overthrown after the miserable failure of the situation in Cuba, and greater attention was then given by the new regime, the transitional regime leading to Brezhnev at the time. But Ho, again, we're talking about the 60s, China was in an awful state. Her collectivization drive slaughtered tens of millions. But Mao was still admired by the regime in this country. But the Sino-Soviet split gave the U.S. A tremendous amount of leverage. And so Ho decided to go with the Soviet Union over the Chinese. Of course, and the Chinese went to Cambodia. Whole separate issue. 1965. Of course, this is several years before Tet. The VC had taken about 80% of the South. That very same year, U.S. Special Forces came under attack. And this is the beginning of this increasing aid to the South and then the buildup of American military forces. The U.S., despite building and training the ARVN, never really gave it much responsibility. But the North Vietnamese had four specific demands very early on for peace. And what by peace, it's the temporary acceptance of the status quo ante, that is to say, the division of the two, division of the country according to the Paris Accords. Of course, the withdrawal of the United States is an obvious one. That peace is to be negotiated using the NLF as a primary factor. That eventual unification without foreign influence, I guess the Soviet Union is the exception to that. And as time went on, the removal, the slow gradual removal of the government in Saigon. In other words, give us everything we want. So it was a silly way to approach it. The Soviets told Ho to keep the war within the bounds of South Vietnam. They did not want this to spread and to give China a reason to move in. Ho rejected China. China rejected Ho, despite the fact the Chinese still had 100,000 men in the northern part of Vietnam. LBJ and the Joint Chiefs of Staff were so incompetent that they asked Ho, as talks developed, and there was always the idea of negotiations hanging over the war from the very beginning to the very end, and they were so ignorant that Ho promised them, that we were not going to use negotiations as an excuse to build up our forces. And LBJ said, oh, okay, that's great. And this is how dumb they are. They simply imported American ideas of honor and trustworthiness onto the communists in North Vietnam, showing how little they understood about Vietnam or Marxism. The Easter Offensive 1972, of course, saw the ARVN fall to pieces. But after that, and this is when the anti-war movement developed, 1973, the draft was eliminated, but Ho said the following. General Thieu, president of South Vietnam, finally some stability needed to be removed. Which, of course, wasn't going to happen except by force. But what are the issues here? The North simply lied about its ideology. It was Leninist, quite explicitly, in its collectivization and everything else, but in public, they spoke of a national communism, a national patriotism. And things like revolutionary and communist were deliberately removed from the vocabulary, and national slogans were promoted. And of course, the minute the war was over, they brought the Marxist stuff back. The ARVN was a great, this is the great tragedy of Vietnam. And Vietnam vets should be, especially the grunts, should be proud because their struggle was to create another South Korea. South Korea became a first world country under General Park. As we said on this show, by the time of his death in the U.S. killed him in 1979. The U.S. was involved in all of these coups d'etats in the South, completely destroying. And there were many Catholic militias, Buddhist militias, Taoist militias, in the South that the U.S. had driven out of the conflict. Anti-communism was extremely popular in the South. Talk about that in a minute. But as we said before, a single ideology, without a single ideology, you can't do anything. Political theory is absolutely essential. Without a unifying ideology, nothing happens. An ideology, among other things, tells you what you're fighting for. What is the state of affairs that you're fighting for when the war is over? What's going to happen? Well, the White Army never had that. U.S. really never had that, except liberal globalization. And the South never had that. The M did, however. We'll talk about that later, too. South Vietnam rejected any kind of diplomacy, and I can't really blame them for that. Communist Party, the Workers' Party of Vietnam, North Vietnam, had the identical plan really since its formation in 1929. And even the earlier manifestations, as far back as 1920, a single plan of action that never changed from 1920 until really 1986. Because the U.S. understood only liberal globalization or Russian communism. Those are the only two ideologies available to their little minds. The U.S. went to war against South Korea, and we've talked about that on this show, and rejected the Thai monarchy on the other hand. So they drove all their enemies out of the war, and after they tried to, were involved in the assassination attempt against General Park in 68, and of course a deliberate loss of the USS Pueblo. I've dealt with that elsewhere too, giving all kinds of secret documents to the Soviet Union deliberately through North Korea. The South, as well as the Thai forces, were pulled out long before 1973. American Joint Chiefs of Staff, typical American officer, very ignorant, very self-assured, very incompetent, refused to learn from the French defeat, and they made the exact same mistakes they did. The North Vietnam government wasn't as stupid. And after the split in 60-61 between the Soviet Union and China, they were able to play off those two powers for influence in the area, which is extremely important. If I, other than the North Vietnam leadership issue, if I had to give a reason for the defeat of South Vietnam, which is identical to the loss of the Vietnam War, it's because by 1965, South Vietnam was completely dependent on the United States. Aid is nothing but a problem. Aid from the U.S. always has strings attached to it. It's not about creating a self-sufficient ally. It's about creating a dependent satrapy. This lost the war, because when the U.S. pulled out in 73, or drew down its forces, really throughout the Nixon administration, the South Vietnamese really had no self-sufficient structures to take its place. Again, because the U.S. had no ideological sophistication, it was liberal globalization or communism. It's one or the other. Those are the only two options. The only philosophical tools they had were to make the middle class in South Vietnam as American as possible, getting them hooked on Coca-Cola and cigarettes and drugs and, you know, typical American bourgeois garbage. The North Vietnamese were smart enough not to fall for this. And although they hated Vietnamese tradition, they did use it in the early years for the sake of building their support. As the U.S. built up its forces, and I told you the tremendous expense of these American bases, especially for the overpaid officer corps, many of whom rarely saw combat, labor costs began to increase because working on an American military base was very high pay. That means Vietnamese technicians, sanitation workers, the best of the best in South Vietnam were quitting their jobs and going on American bases and working there. These were prized jobs, and there was a premium attached to them. Sometimes, as these coup d'etat went on and on, the ARVN was accused of taking construction materials that were meant for housing for South Vietnamese people and selling them on the black market. And of course, there was always the accusation, which I believe is false, that people like General Key, who I do admire, and few were involved in the heroin trade. That doesn't make much sense, because they were getting such a tremendous amount of aid and material from the U.S. Why blow a good thing on a trade that was going to lead to nothing but destruction? Now, the North, that's another matter. Ultimately, aid and assistance hurt and eventually destroyed the South Vietnamese economy, because it is based on 1960s bourgeois American ideology. And because Americans didn't know anything else, it was just this clash that led to the U.S. becoming quite unpopular. Now, I mentioned in 1945 to 1947, there was a massive flood in North Vietnam. The Japanese forces that remained in 1945, as well as the French, began hoarding goods for themselves, making the matter far more. About 2 million were killed by starvation. The floods destroyed the rice paddies. But in 1945, Ho Chi Minh declared Vietnamese independence. which gave him a certain amount of power. I mean, France had just barely got itself back together again. They did very little about it at the time. But it gave Ho a certain amount of power and legitimacy, and some reorganization and some land redistribution helped cement his authority in the area. Again, he believed in collectivization, not land ownership. Those are two opposite things. But early on, when he didn't have quite the control over the society yet, he made believe that he was interested in some redistribution and engaged in some of it, and that's what rescued the economy and gave Ho a certain legitimacy in the north. Ho did say something that was true, though. He did say that North and South Vietnam, very different from one another, are one nation, and they are one economic unit. Food production is really southern. And as I said before, the Ho Chi Minh's attempt to create some kind of a friendly, like, it wasn't really friendly, it was an attempt to destroy them, but his refusal, Diem's refusal to sell rice to Ho, which is a good idea, created the NLF, which gave him the excuse to create the NLF in 1960. So there's one fact. I mean, the officer corps in the U.S., again, overpaid, arrogant, less so during Vietnam, more so, I mean, today they're insufferable, but less so during Vietnam. You still had a traditional military force. Today, the U.S. military is a liberal apparatus designed for liberal goals and generally defeat in war. But that wasn't the case in the 60s. I mean, it was showing itself. But one of the problems was this constant rotation of officers. You had guys with very, very little combat experience being sent with combat-hardened men into the jungle. To some extent, this is where fragging came from. You notice there's none of that today. There's a lot of desertion today. But the ruling class was so viciously against the Vietnam War that they would do anything, including killing their own officers, for the sake of an American defeat. That is not the case where nationalist and religious governments are the target, especially when Israel is a primary beneficiary. But a study was done in the late 70s showing that low-level officers with more than 6 months combat experience lost 1.6 men per month. Those with less than 6 months combat experience lost almost 3 men a month. So clearly the rapid rotation, you know, the quick, kind of silly idea that a second lieutenant outranks a high-ranking sergeant, it's such a dumb notion. But this is one of the things that lost a lot of lives unnecessarily. Of course, they didn't keep these guys from pinning medals on themselves. Many of the grunts saw the officer corps, not the VC, as the enemy. And the rotations of quite privileged officers and with grunts, corporals, sergeants, PVCs, specialists, etc., who actually knew what they were doing, was the cause of tremendous divisions in the U.S. force. And the U.S. has learned nothing from this. They are so dumb and so incompetent in military matters that they thought that victory meant that they kill more North Vietnamese than they kill Americans, which is such an idiotic way of approaching warfare. But in order to tell their superiors the good news, any dead body that looked vaguely Vietnamese was automatically a dead VC. The fact is that the U.S. is, well, again, the French made the same mistake, the U.S. being arrogant, didn't learn anything from it. They underestimated and underreported the strength of both North Vietnamese regulars as well as the NLF. Ho did something that the regime in Saigon, and these were good men on an individual level, but an institutional level is another matter. Ho approached the war as an economic matter. War is economic. Labor in the factories, in the fields, was no different than a soldier with a rifle. And that happens to be true, especially for a war of national liberation. Production is just another version of combat. It was so easy for him to use national slogans, without being a nationalist himself, but using these slogans as a way to connect economic development with military progress and everything for the war. A laborer is a warrior. Collectivization, although a disaster, every place has been tried. was accomplished in North Vietnam, however poorly, as a battle in and of its own, as it was viewed. Now in the U.S., the anti-war movement was created and financed by the elite. We can go on and on, the MacArthur Foundation, Rockefeller Foundation. The U.S. government, again, underestimating the resolve of North Vietnam, learning nothing from Korea, learning nothing from World War II, for that matter, in the Soviet era, began to see a strain on the economy. Both the French and the Americans weren't willing to commit the men and the resources that were necessary for a victory in this particular kind of war. 10% tax on consumption was instituted in the U.S. in 1968. LBJ, after launching the Great Society in 1964, after his defeat of Goldwater, then abandoned it and cut his new program, a non-defense spending at the time, by $10 billion, which was a ton of money in 1968. I'm sorry, 67, 66, Nixon won in 1968. So in LBJ's mind, the Great Society was essentially over. 50% cuts in the programs that he just a few years earlier had trumpeted as the Great Society. What he didn't understand is when you have this sudden spike in demand that the war caused, supplying militarily, in terms of foodstuffs, in terms of medical supplies, this massive spike in demand from 66, 67 on created inflation, created unemployment, a sharp rise in prices across the board. Even this was too much for the Americans to handle. But the North Vietnamese were willing to lose millions upon millions. And if that doesn't explain the cause of the war, then I can't help you any further. The consequences. South Vietnam lost about not quite a million men, including civilians, total deaths. But by the end of the war, say 1975, 1980, you had massive areas of rural Vietnam, north and south, that had been completely depopulated. Agent Orange had defoliated much of the jungle. You had millions of soldiers, north and south, that needed to be demobilized. And as soon as the U.S. is defeated in Vietnam, they now have to invade Cambodia to get rid of Pol Pot and Chinese influence, and of course have a northern border war with China, which they also win. And they won it with China for the same reason that the U.S. lost, that the French lost. The Chinese had their own issues and were not prepared to mobilize this entire economy to defeat Vietnam. However, the North Vietnamese, I should say now Vietnam, as a unified society under the communists, was willing to mobilize everything and anything to defeat and to win these wars. So France, China, Cambodia, the U.S., and Saigon, all defeated one after another by this political will of the Workers' Party, making believe that it was a nationalist party. In 1978, all private enterprise is banned in the entire country, and a low-level civil war develops because, especially in the South, where farmers, by the way, none of this was reported in the press in the U.S., they began resisting collectivization. That means by the end of the 70s, Vietnam was one of the poorest countries in the world. And what the Communist Party in Vietnam began to realize, it's one thing to demand mobilization for the purposes of fighting an enemy in war, especially a foreign enemy. But that same mobilization for the sake of serving the party, that's another matter. So in 1986, the Doi Moi program was created, where you had some very partial acceptance of private property in the market. Now, as far as the South was concerned, anyone associated with the ARVN was excluded. And, you know, it's one thing when you're fighting a war, you know, the national communist idea, one nation, one Vietnam. And it should be noted, by the way, that the Northern Communist Party during the war was mostly Southern. These were Southern political activists who had migrated north. And really, even, you know, as early as the early 60s, the Soviets had demanded peaceful reunification. And the Communist Party, the Workers' Party in Hanoi, was pragmatic. That pragmatism went out the window when they unified the country up until 1986. And really what began this, you know, we talked about the consequences of the war and then the origins of the war. And, again, it underscores the issue. It's one thing to mobilize society against a foreign enemy. That's easy. Mobilizing society in peacetime is not easy. There was an anti-Diem movement in South Vietnam. And Ho Chi Minh's great fear was that this is going to explode into a civil war that the North does not control. But as I said before, from the Tet Offensive to roughly 71, the ARVN had won the war. The NLF was destroyed. North Vietnam was struggling. Soviet aid was back and forth. They were at war with China. You know, at least a war of words at the time. And of course, the American incompetence was such that they didn't know how to follow up on this. Regardless, Hanoi's political will won it. And I'll say this over and over again. But the beginning of the war, you know, we could even talk about the war against the French as essential to understanding how the North won the war. Because while the U.S. refused to learn anything from the French defeat, the North was quite the opposite. Let's face it, after the war against France, the NVA needed a break. But this wasn't going to happen. I think that Ho exaggerated the movement against President Diem in Saigon. But that's the great fear. Now, General Giap, who we all have heard of, was very much against a war against the South. He said, we don't have the men, we don't have the economy, we can't really trust the Soviet Union, they don't really care that much here. But then, a guy by the name of Than, who was very much a hardcore Leninist, went to war against Giap, and you had his kind of a Clausewitzian understanding of war versus General Giap's Maoist conception of war. As I said before, Resolution 15, 1959, declared war in the South, and 1960, the Viet Cong was created. You see, whether it be the French, the Chinese, or the Americans, the North declared a total war. What is a total war? Total war is when the entire economy, the entire productive capacity of a nation is mobilized for the war effort. Right? There is no such thing as a 42 or 43 Chevy or Ford because they weren't making cars. North Vietnamese were willing to declare total war, and they did. But certainly the French weren't. There were no position to do this in the 50s anyway. The Dutch weren't going to do this in Indonesia. The British weren't going to do it in Malaysia. And the U.S. wasn't going to do it in Vietnam, Korea, or pretty much anywhere else. Again, Ho was right. The U.S. can't handle losses if those losses are against communists. Against nationalists, of course, you can nuke the country and no one will care. But against communists, it's a different story. 1969, something happened, though. This was reported in a distorted way in the American press, because the American press had declared itself for the North. Again, this was, it did not happen against, you know, Saddam Hussein or Afghanistan. If nationalism is the enemy, then there is no anti-war movement, and the war is accepted by all factions of society. It's against communists, it's a different story. The ruling class hated this. But General Thieu challenged the North to an open election, organized by an international body. Let's see who has the popularity here. Well, of course, what was not reported in the American press was the North said no. And they said a stupid thing. They said, well, because you're going to be controlling the election. And General Thieu said, I'm not. I will put this in the hands. I don't care if it's the UN. I don't care if it's the Bulgarians. I don't care who it is. I will not be in charge of this because that would be, and I guarantee I'll win. And the North, frightened of this, said no and continued the war. This is how we know that the North Vietnamese were never quite popular. This is how we know, and we'll see this civil war that continued to plague Vietnam right up until the 80s, when collectivization was finally abandoned. But what happened with France? Because to understand the Vietnam War, you have to understand the war against France in the 1950s. The French had performed poorly prior to 1952. New general, de la Thierry, had taken command. And he realized a few things, things that the Americans hadn't figured out. He needed a mobile force. He needed more men and resources, which he never received. He did win a few victories. There was some prejudice against offensive operations, but then he declared Operation Lorraine, 1952, the end of 1952, where there was a counterattack against the Viet Minh. And the Black River, the French were defeated. But even where, the Red River, for example, where the Vietnamese were defeated, these were always Pyrrhic victories. The French, even though they had destroyed much of the Viet Minh, had lost so much themselves that after a short pause, the Viet Minh were ready to rebuild. But what happens? The end of 1952, 30,000 mobile French forces defeated the Viet Minh. Just like the U.S. after Tet, the French didn't know how to follow up. And part of the reason was the French supply lines had grown too long. And the French required supplies from the road system, and that also meant that it became vulnerable to Viet Minh guerrilla attacks. There's a few reasons, really six or seven, I think, that the French lost. And you can't really, it's very easy to, you can't avoid applying this to the United States. Number one, the French were unwilling to commit the men necessary, especially after World War II. I mean, the French was still in trouble. Number two, they underestimated the Vietnamese forces, which was, even the Chinese did that. Number three, we said this about the U.S., 70% of the French forces, just like in the American version, were protecting the rear, that is to say, supplies and communications. This is why only 15% of the American forces in Vietnam were combat ready. Their job, just like the ARVN, was to protect these vital but non-offensive areas. Supply needed roads, number five. And number six, of course, the Vietnamese knew the area. This, you know, in a jungle, especially a mountainous jungle, the advantages of the U.S. or even South Vietnam, that is to say, in armor and air power, didn't matter very much. The fact of the matter is that, and one of these reasons is that because the Vietnamese, I think I actually got out of order here. This is actually number six. The Vietnamese had a very primitive Spartan supply system that was also very effective, very, these guys were living on very little, but they could do that. And because of that, it was tough to detect, tough to destroy, and very, very, very flexible. In the South, once the Paris Accords were signed, Diem takes over the South. After the overthrow of Diem and his murder by the CIA under Kennedy, there was no stability in the South really until the end under General Thieu. These coups, one after another, used up manpower. They used up supplies. They destroyed the leadership capacity. This was a conscript army with no sense of village life, no sense of the holiday season system, no connection to the economy, the very opposite of the northern approach to conscription. One thing the North Vietnamese did, now they were going to destroy this as soon as they won, but during the war itself, they connected village family life and the holiday structure and how the year was divided within the army itself. And Saigon simply was following the Western idea that had no conception of these kind of things, because a family is not significant. The individual matters in Western law. Everywhere else, natural law to some extent reigns, where the family, the extended family, is the center of everything. And this is one of the things that gave the North a tremendous advantage that you'll never hear in any textbook. The United States made a huge blunder in pulling the ARV in back, completely taking over all offensive operations, which was a way to tell the world that we don't trust ARVN and we think they're incompetent. Obviously, the North noticed this. It wasn't true, by the way. But again, the U.S. knew nothing about Vietnam. Doesn't know anything about Vietnam today. And learned nothing. The truth of the matter is that Hanoi saw stalemate as the same thing as victory, just like the Chinese did in Korea. Nothing changed in the American mind. That's what arrogance and liberalism will do. It will corrode the American mind. But as I said, the ARVN was seen, especially in armor and artillery, and in the air, as a formidable force that should not be underestimated. But after 73, as Nixon began winding the war down, and after Nixon destroyed George McGovern in 72, the South, being dependent on the U.S., being the opposite of self-sufficient, began experiencing fuel and ammo shortages. And everything that they had an advantage in, jets, tanks, APCs, artillery, no longer moved. They were able to shoot two or three artillery rounds a day, if that. The Soviets now lavishly supplying the NVA under Brezhnev. But the ARVN was anything but incompetent, if led properly. For example, General Li Mingyao was a brigadier general who commanded the 18th armored unit, which 18th armored division, which held out for a full week against seven regular North Vietnamese units near the end of the war. So, with competent leadership with a guy like him, the ARVN was extremely competent, and these guys would kill themselves rather than surrender near the end of the war. So the devotion was there. The focus was there. The competence was there. The will to win was there. But in the South, you had the mirror image of the North, the complete opposite of the North. The North had a single leader, a single ideology, a single party, a single everything, which means victory, despite being quite inferior in every other way. The South had one coup after another. These men, as I say, individually are competent. Institutionally, it was not a matter of incompetence. They just simply couldn't function. The U.S. simply could not be trusted to properly use these native forces. So Vietnamization was a joke because the U.S. had just made the South dependent on the U.S. So what could Vietnamization be? So, as I said, the consequences of the defeat were extraordinary. Collectivization, mass executions, the camp system. There were a total of 150 re-education camps. And so many of the hippies, Joan Baez, airhead though she was, said the anti-war movement was wrong. Because we were supporting Ho Chi Minh, who the American press, the American elite, were saying is this wonderful man, a liberal reformer. The press never referred to him as a communist, but as a nationalist or a liberal reformer with communist leadings or some ridiculousness like that. Re-education camps were dotted the landscapes everywhere. It was a total purge of Southern society. And the camps where ARVN guys would go, anybody even remotely, you gotta remember something. The VC were a terrorist organization. And I could say that because they were quite proud of this. Killing civilians wasn't an anomaly. It was a part of the VC operation, and they had quotas. And I've written about this elsewhere. The VC propaganda, which would come over in very bad English on the radio, would talk about units that were given awards for killing civilians in southern villages. So through terror, they would gain the support, and then once they came over, they would get a certain promise of land, and then that would be overthrown, and then it would be collectivized. That was the very Machiavellian strategy here. But essentially these 150, at least 150 re-education camps had a very strict regimen. You'd wake at 5, you'd work from 7 to roughly noon, you'd then work from 1 to essentially 1800 hours, and then, you know, you're talking about maybe 1.5 kilograms a day ration, barely starvation wages here. But in 1900, you would have your classroom propaganda, and it would be an extremely intensive political propaganda thing. And you'd go to bed at 2300, so you're talking about almost midnight for a lot of these guys, and then getting up at 5. So you have, at maximum, 5 hours of sleep, 1.5 kilograms a day, nonstop work, and the things that you produce, so much for Marxism. The whole notion of the alienation of labor was institutionalized here, because whatever they produced in the camp was sent elsewhere. But strict rationing was always the issue here. As I said before, by 1988, or even before, Vietnam became one of the poorest nations. And yet, if the Southern society had been preserved, you would have another South Korea there today. Grand total, $100 billion in 1970 dollars. 1970 valuation was given to the South. Most of it was completely wasted. The last thing I'm going to mention, of course, is during the war, the massive migration, sort of like the white emigres from Russia during the Civil War. You had the white emigres from the North heading south. Tremendous writers and intellectuals, Win Kia Trung, Huang Van Chi, To Van, Win Jian Hung, Tran Kuo Dao, who, by the way, created the term the Great Migration, the massive migration of emigres from the North to the South. And these men spoke of the labor camps, the torture, the murder of civilians to a deaf Western world. And one of the things they said is that the North were taking advantage of American stupidity and American ignorance. The Catholic nationalism of President Diem was seen as a totalitarian Bolshevist threat, believe it or not, by the American policymakers, and this is why he was murdered. And again, we're talking about causes here. The overthrow of Diem was the overthrow of stability and showed that the U.S. did everything in its power to lose this war. And it led to the murder of thousands, if not millions, and the destruction of the economy. So those who lost their lives in the Vietnam War, the grunts, the conscripts, at least that was the attempt to create a prosperous country, a national socialist country like you had in Taiwan or South Korea, but they failed because of American stupidity, American arrogance, American exceptionalism, and globalization. And that, of course, always is your enemy, and they have learned nothing. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.